Hi, this is Tish Perlman. This week we're going to present an encore broadcast of my interview with Diane Ackerman. We interviewed her when her work, The Zookeeper's Wife, was first published in late 2007, and the book's been on the New York Times bestseller list for many months now. And I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Out of Bounds. My guest is Diane Ackerman. Ackerman is a poet, essayist, and naturalist. She is the author of many highly acclaimed works of nonfiction, including the bestseller, A Natural History of the Senses. She's also published many collections of poetry, including the very personal and powerful Origami Bridges. Her most recent book is a work of nonfiction, The Zookeeper's Wife, published by W.W. Norton. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you.
Now you've been a prolific writer, natural history, poetry, essays. What was it that started you on this journey to be a writer?
To be a writer, oh my heavens, I've been writing as long as I can remember. My mom told me that she would get phone calls from her neighbors saying, "Marcia, your daughter's talking to herself on her way home from school again." And you know, that was like first grade or second grade. So I was always making up stories and finding ways to escape into other worlds. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I could, I started writing poetry. I wrote poetry for a long time. And then needed a little more elbow room, so now I write prose, too.
Mm-hmm. And how did you acquire your love for nature?
I've always been intimately close to nature. It was my playground when I was little. That was before Game Boys and electronics and so on. And so we just would beg to go outside and play. And a typical day would include being up to my shoulder inside of a tree trunk or mucking around in a creek or something like that. I always felt part of nature. And children are. They get discouraged away from it, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Were you brought up in a rural setting? You were brought up in Illinois, right?
Yes. I was in suburbia, northwest of Chicago. Mm. But it was right at the edge of a little town called Waukegan. And beyond our houses, there really was nothing but fields and occasional tractors. Those were the tallest things, other than trees. And it really was possible to be out and playing in nature. And also, I had to walk through a plum orchard on the way to school. And that was wonderful. And it also taught me an important lesson. I remember being maybe 7 years old, and I was walking through the plum orchard with two other little girls, and I was dawdling because I looked up and I saw these ripe plums hanging above me, and they looked like bats. They were just huddled up that way and the right color, and I was mystified. And when my friends came back and said, "What are you looking at?" and I said, "The plums, the bats." They were absolutely horrified. And they weren't scared of the bats. They were scared that there was somebody who could look at plums and think they were bats.
Oh, so they thought you were a witch.
They thought I was very strange. And so I learned early on that I needed to hide the poetic sensibility. Mm-hmm. And that was true for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad you finally let it out.
Oh, well, thank you.
Now, let's talk about your current work, The Zookeeper's Wife. This is not a well-known story from World War II. How did you find out about this story, and tell us a bit about it?
Well, this really concerns one of the best hideouts, most successful hideouts of World War II. And it happened that the zookeeper at the Warsaw Zoo and his wife, Antonina, when their zoo was bombed, decided to turn the devastated zoo into an asylum for escaping refugees. They were Christian. They could easily have survived the war, but they risked their own lives and the life of their son, who was 5, 6, 7 at the time of the war, to save over 300 doomed people. Mm-hmm. And they did it with enormous heart and creativity, because it took a lot of that. And at the same time, they were adopting orphan wild animals. So the house was full of all kinds of bizarre creatures and also lots of humans who were hidden away, and a lot of the humans were hidden in the cages. And this was the last place that the Nazis thought to look mm-hmm. for people. And so it was very successful, but they had a lot of near misses. The way I came to this story is partly through my grandparents, who were Polish, and they told me that there was a kind of lost-in-time forest in Poland. I now know that this is the forest on the border with Belarusia. It's called Białowieża, and it's an amazing place where there are 500-year-old trees. It's the last fragment of lowland primeval forest left in all of Europe today. And one thing led to another, and through my researches, I began to discover that there were ancient-looking horses and bison running around there, and that all of it had to do somehow with Nazi perversity. And it turned out that during the war, Goering decided that the high command would need pure Aryan horses to ride, pure Aryan game to hunt, and of course a sublime wilderness to use as a royal game preserve. Mm-hmm. And the one place where you could find all of those things was in Poland. And the zookeeper was the world's authority on some of these animals and had had great success in breeding endangered animals. So he became essential. And it really was partly through this Nazi lunacy that this amazing forest with countless endangered animals survives today, and hundreds of people also who made their way through this underground railroad survived too.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you heard about this through your grandparents, but
partly
through your grandparents. But how did you do your research?
Well, I was fortunate in that I needed somebody to translate from Polish. And a friend of mine locally said that she had a friend who had spent her first 26 years in Poland, Magda Day. And I got in touch with her and asked if she could translate for me. And we very quickly discovered that one of her uncles was a vet at the time of the war, who had done some work at the zoo, that the zookeeper's wife had written a memoir, and he got his hands on it. So she could translate that for me. And then there were lots of testimonies, I found, that had been filed after the war by people who had sheltered at the zoo, or interviews with the zookeeper and his wife in Yiddish, Hebrew, Polish. So I had all of those translated. And, of course, I needed to find out about World War II in Poland, which is itself an amazing story.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I read everything I could get my hands on the history of Poland, on World War II, on the natural history in Poland at that time, the animals and plants that would have surrounded Antonina.
And you must have been totally fascinated by all that.
Oh, I love that. I really love that. And ultimately, I went to the new Warsaw Zoo, the house that Antonina lived in, the villa where all these people were hidden, still survives in the middle of the zoo. So I was able to go there, lie down in the bed, stand on the terrace and see some of what she saw, hear the animals that she heard making their calls and waking up in the morning and things like that. And so it was possible to commune with her and not to invent anything, but to be able to record the texture of everyday life that she would have been part of. Mm-hmm. And she had very alert, vivid senses. She was very attuned to nature and to animals.
Yeah, you use a lot of excerpts from her journals, and they're quite astonishing. Now, do they still have living family members?
The son is
and,
alive.
And did they try to direct you in any way, in which way you would write this story?
Not
Were
in
there
the
any
least.
Restrictions at all on this?
Absolutely none. I had wonderful talks with the new zookeeper and his wife, and I got chills. You know, I thought, this is the zookeeper's wife now. This is amazing. They have been so encouraging and wonderful, and they love the book. And they provided photographs from the archives of the old zoo. And the zookeeper there now told me that when he was a little boy, he worked for Jan Żabinski as a volunteer and told him that when he grew up, he was going to be a zookeeper. And sure enough, he is. The son is now 77, was very surprised to hear from me, was kind of surprised that I would find his family remarkable. And I said, but you were so heroic, the whole family was. And he explained, but this was normal for me. Mm-hmm. This was the only life I knew
He was quite heroic as a little boy, too.
He really was.
You portray him in the book. It's amazing.
He really was. They would give him, like, bowls of soup or stew and hunks of bread and say to him, I think maybe the lions could be hungry, or why don't you go feed the possums or the bears or something like that? Because all of the people in hiding were given the code name of the animal that had lived in the cage where they were hiding. So this was the way that they used code and their son as messenger to not be picked up by the Nazis at any point. They rightly assumed that the Nazis would never, never suspect a child that young of being an essential part.
Mm-hmm. And then to be able to be deceptive in an incredibly convincing way.
Very convincing way, very complex way. And there were people hidden between the walls and underground and in closets and every place, sometimes as many as 50 at a time mm-hmm. on the zoo grounds. And Jan was also a very active part of the resistance. He led a cell of saboteurs that specialized in bombing trains and doing other kinds of things, many of which Antonina didn't really find out about until the end of the war. He was afraid to tell her because he thought she would rightly be way too scared for her own life and the life of their son.
Now, did this become a kind of a personal story for you because your maternal grandparents were from Poland?
It became a personal story even more because Antonina was such a remarkable woman. And in some ways, I identified with her, with the seamless way that she felt part of nature, with her eagerness to unravel her human self and slide into the sensibility of an animal. And she wrote children's books from that perspective. She was very compassionate. She cared a lot about neighbors helping neighbors. There were many more ways in which we differed. Among them, she was tall and slender and blonde and could play piano and, you know, things like a Catholic and things like that. Uh-huh. But I just found her an amazing woman because she was determined that all of these people not just survive, but survive with their humanity intact. And so after dark every evening, they would come out and they would have dinner party. And since the house was full of bizarre animals, there was the innocence of the hijinks of all the animals to distract them. They could have discussions and socialize. And there were piano concerts every night.
I was very taken by that aspect of it.
Yes, there was a professional pianist there and many musical people and artistic people among them. And with one thing or another, she said that they lived an almost festive underground existence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she didn't describe it that way. Now, The Zookeeper's Wife almost reads like fiction to me. It's so seamlessly, wonderfully put together. Did you have to use any fictionalization or just imagining?
Nope, none of it.
None at all, huh?
None at all. Every time somebody speaks, I'm quoting directly from them, from something that they wrote or interviews that they gave. And the rest of the scenes, no, these came straight from Antonina and other people. I had to provide a lot of the texture from nature, but I could do that when the zoo was bombed and, for example, the alligator, I say, pushes up onto its toes and trots away. Mm. I've seen alligators do that. I know that's what they do when they escape. So through research and observation, I could fill it all in.
I was wondering about that. If you're just joining us, my guest is award-winning writer Diane Ackerman. Because the reason why I ask you that, because I remember in an early interview you said that you consider fiction a very high-class form of lying.
So I do.
I was thinking that perhaps you still believe that.
I still believe that, and I love it, but I'm not very good at it.
you love fiction.
Fiction, mm-hmm. Exactly. But in any case, if I had written this as a historical novel, in a kind of Virginia Woolf stream of consciousness way, mm-hmm. which I would have loved to have done. the zoo waves, there we go. If I had done that, I would have enjoyed it, but people would not have believed me. They would have said, she made this up. What's remarkable is that In those days of genocide, and in our own days of genocide, there are people who will sacrifice their lives for the survival of perfect strangers. There are people who perform radical acts of compassion, subversive compassion. We just don't hear about it. We somehow have been taught the myth of the warrior hero.
Mm.
We haven't been taught about compassionate heroism. And so when we turn on our televisions and we pick up our newspapers, all we hear about is violence associated with heroism. But I'm convinced that there are rescuers and their equivalents all over the planet today. There always have been. We just aren't taught very much about them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really time that we were, because that is a kind of heroism and bravery that is very hard to find. Very hard to find in oneself. I can't help but ask myself, would I have been able to do this, especially if I had a young son?
I think a lot of people would ask themselves that question when they read this book. Because I'm amazed that they didn't at some points get so frightened that they ran away from this.
And they were
terrified.
They
stuck with it for years.
They stuck with it for 3 years solid. And it's not that they weren't scared. They were scared.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that you do even though you're frightened, because they're the right things to do. And one of the most startling things about rescuers in general, because many of them were interviewed after the war, is that every single one of them said, oh, I didn't do anything special. I didn't do anything heroic. It's what anyone would have done in my situation, because it was just the right thing to do.
Yeah, one does hear that, but one does not believe that anyone would do it.
And yet, thousands upon thousands did, especially in Poland.
Mm.
Also, we hear so often that the Poles were the ones who put the Jews in concentration camps. Somehow that is a popular misconception. So I hope that the book makes clear that, no, as a matter of fact, Poland was marked for destruction by the Nazis. All of the Slavs were to be either killed or turned into labor. And the concentration camp were built by the Nazis. 3 million Poles, Catholic Poles, died in them, as well as all of the Jews. And in Warsaw alone, there were tens of thousands of Poles who had to do things actively or tacitly to make it possible for Jews in hiding and other members of the underground to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say actively or tacitly, a great many of them actively were involved in this process. But there were also all of those people who looked the other way, who didn't turn people in when they could have, who didn't blackmail them.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of blackmailers, but there were a lot of people who didn't, and those are the ones I'm interested in. People like the mailmen, you know, the maids, the milkmen, people who knew that there were more mouths to feed and other people present, but just didn't turn them in.
Mm-hmm. It is quite remarkable. Now there's something that I wasn't aware of that you talk about in your book, and I'm sure this fascinated you. I was not aware of the way the Nazis were uprooting native plants in Poland in order to, you know, to put in pure German botanicals. You know?
That
shocked me.
That really shocked me, too. I had never read this or heard of this. But I've learned since then even more about it. By our standards, the Nazis were incredibly green. They led the world in environmentalism. And they believed in the beauty and nobility of all plants and animals, except, of course, for those that were Jewish, Slavic, Gypsy, homosexual. You know, yeah, lots of other things. And they were so twisted in their thinking about this, that on the one hand, they could operate on children in the concentration camps without any painkillers whatsoever. And on the other, there was a famous scientist who was punished for not giving worms enough anesthesia during an experiment. They were totally paradoxical in their thinking about it. And the zookeepers were able to capitalize on that paradox. What the Nazis wanted to do was breed back to pure, now extinct, animals, because they felt those would be the pure Aryan animals. And so they were sending people to gather animals that looked the most like the ones that the Ice Age hunters painted on the cave walls and try to breed them together. And they were sending botanical commando squads all over the world to sneak into botanical gardens and steal the best specimens and bring them home for these breeding experiments. And of course, most people do know that they were trying to breed together the most Nordic-looking humans. That was going on. But it was their intention to drain 100,000 acres of marshland and turn it into farmland, to plant forests. This would certainly have led to climate change. They wanted to control the genetic destiny of the entire planet. Mm-hmm. And they were starting with Poland, and then they were going to move on to other nations and do exactly the same thing until really only their genes remained.
That's an astonishing
it is.
Piece of history.
And also astonishing how close they came.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, the Jabinskis, is that how you say their name?
Jabinskis.
They saved 300 Jews. Did you get an opportunity to meet with any of these people? Are any of them still alive?
I'm sure that some of them, a scant few, must be alive. It's more likely their children would be alive, or perhaps ones who were children at the time of the war. I haven't heard from them, but I'm hoping that I will. I did hear from a woman whose aunt, she tells me, was a student in high school, a student of Jan Jabinski's after the war, and I learned a little more about what became of him in that way. Thus far, I haven't really had contact with the people who sheltered with him, but the book will be coming out in Poland next September. And I bet I'll hear from people then.
I'll bet you will as well, yeah. Now, did the researching and writing of this book change your perspective at all about the Holocaust and what you had known up until this time?
It really did. As I said, my grandparents were from Poland, but I knew very little about Poland. Now,
really?
I've been there, and I've been to the forest and the farmlands and some of the cities and discovered that Poland is a very beautiful country. I hadn't realized that. And I have a much larger idea of the sights and sounds and nature that surrounded my grandparents and their grandparents and so on. So my version of my lineage, of my past, now has been fleshed out into the natural world in a much larger sense. And that's wonderful. I knew absolutely nothing about Poland during World War II, and of course I had to come up to speed fast on it. I've learned so much about the Blitzkrieg and Poland, all the way down to the saints that were appealed to and the clothes that people wore. I was able to interview two women now in their 80s who had been girl messengers with the underground during the war and who went to the zoo. And that was very helpful. I could ask them, what did people wear? What did you eat? What did the air smell like? Were the birds still there? Lots of things like that.
Uh-huh. So this got you in touch with a little aspect of yourself.
Yes, very much so.
And did it bring out the poet in you? Are you going to have some poems streaming from this experience?
Inevitably.
have you started?
Not yet, but inevitably.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about your poetry. Your poetry is so personal, and it's so raw sometimes. Do you ever feel like you're making yourself too vulnerable?
I think you must be referring to Origami Bridges.
and also the one about...
I Praise My Destroyer.
I Praise My Destroyer.
Yes. In some of these poems, more and more of late, I've been revealing more about myself. When Origami Bridges came out, a friend of mine said that he really liked the craft of the poems, but he just didn't want to know that much about me.
Really?
Which was surprising, but he was the only one who said that. Other people have been very responsive. Origami Bridges really is a record of the psychotherapy relationship over a period of a year. I was writing about a poem a day and making contact with the experience, coming to understand it, and at a certain point, because I was sending the poems to my therapist as well, we were able to use the poems also in the therapy, and that was incredibly valuable. And I've had people tell me that they've used the book in that way, too, where they've taken it into their therapist and they've said, see this poem here on page 27? That's exactly what I've been feeling, something like that. I suppose that as I'm getting older, I'm risking more of myself in public, risking being a little bit more personal. Mm-hmm. A lot of the poetry still is about nature. And when I write prose poems, which is what I'm working on at the moment about nature, kind of vignettes, I'm not in them so much. The question is, will I become in them? Will I enter them more as the series progresses? I think that's probably true.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me because you strike me as a very person, a very private person.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you bring us into your own personal wilderness with a lot of these poems.
Personal wilderness.
Which is amazing.
Is right. That's very much what poetry can be because you're being private in public. I mean, all artists are private in public. And when people come up to me, like at readings, at signings, so on, and say, I feel like I know you, and you lead such an interesting life, and my life is so boring, I reassure them that they only see the parts of me I want them to, mm-hmm. that my books truly are me, but they're not all of me. Some people I've met, some authors, have surprised me because they're not their books. The books were the best mm-hmm. that they rose to in mm-hmm. very special moments. Mm-hmm. Frost is a good example. I didn't meet Frost, but an example of someone like that. The poems are very humane and compassionate, but he was not,
exactly.
apparently.
Yeah.
And that can be, but my books are very much me. As I say, they're just not all of me.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you this as a naturalist. You write extensively about the juxtaposition between nature and humans and so on. Are you worried about this high-tech, machine-oriented world that we're evolving into, people losing touch with nature?
I've been worried about that for a long time. I mentioned that children play indoors now more than ever, and I'm not sure that that's a healthy thing. We've exiled ourselves more and more from nature, and I think there's a great loneliness that we feel as a result of that, because we evolve to be part of the seasons. When I go to big cities, I'm startled. I usually get a shudder by the fact that the constellations are on the ground.
Mm.
We didn't evolve to have constellations on the ground. And of course, we can adapt to all of these things because we're very adaptive. But our emotions are Pleistocene. Our desires are very ancient. We haven't grown up to the state of technology that we live at. I do love technology. I certainly use email and computers, and I'm grateful for them. But I think it's really important that they are part of a balanced life that also includes being in touch with nature, not just because it's good for the natural world that we need to protect, but for eco-psychological reasons,
mm-hmm.
because it's good for our own health.
Mm-hmm. Diane Ackerman, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And to my listeners, please go get a copy of The Zookeeper's Wife. It's a fascinating piece of our history. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.